2003 marks the 100th anniversary of Lou Gehrig's birth. Heinrich Ludwig Gehrig came into the world a big-boned, sturdy, nearly 14-pound baby boy on June 19th, 1903. The year he was born, two historic events occurred, creating arenas in which Lou Gehrig would excel. Early in the year, a Baltimore franchise of the American League was purchased for only $18,000 and then moved to Manhattan. The Highlanders, as they were soon called, lagged far behind New York's more popular teams, the Brooklyn Dodgers and the New York Giants. But the Highlanders became the New York Yankees, and Lou Gehrig holds a singular place in that pantheon of Yankee players. The second landmark event came in the fall, when the first World Series, as we know it, the first one, was played between the Boston Red Sox and the Pittsburgh Pirates. By the way, the Red Sox won. There were so many great days of autumn ahead for Lou Gehrig when the Yankees would win. During his career, he acquired 6 World Series rings. Lou Gehrig's future was, of course, unknowable. And to his parents, his fame might have also seemed unimaginable. For Lou's parents were two individuals in that great tide of impoverished immigrants who entered America, overflowing the streets of New York. Although both of his parents were from Germany, his mother, Christina, and his father, Heinrich, met and married in New York City. They had 3 other children. Yet tragically, Lou was the only child to survive infancy. And perhaps such a sorrow just fueled the fierceness of his mother's love. All her life, she tried to hold him very close. By all accounts, Mom was a pugnacious woman. She certainly was the backbone of the family. She worked hard as a domestic, a cleaning lady, who also labored extra long hours cooking, sewing, washing for others. From her, Lou learned about being industrious, ambitious. He learned about being tenacious and thrifty. Pop Gehrig was Mom's opposite. Pop liked to be out of the apartment. Pop liked to be in the corner bar. He liked drinking and playing pinochle for money. And, oh, Pop liked to sleep a great deal. He had health and employment problems all of his life. But Pop took his Louis to the gym. At that time, gyms were very popular among German immigrant men. There, the men socialized as well as exercised. Going to the gym with his father, climbing ropes, traversing parallel bars, these exercises just built up Lou's strength, and they did develop his body. He was unwittingly beginning the life of an athlete. He was building both his stamina and his discipline. When Lou entered high school, he was solidly built. He already weighed 200 pounds. His dad was more supportive than his mom of his interest in sports. One Christmas, Pop Gehrig even bought a catcher's mitt for Lou. Unfortunately, he bought his left-handed son a catcher's mitt made for a right-handed player. Christina Gehrig pushed education, not sports. Sports were for bummers. Sports were just an indulgence only rich kids could afford. She believed in education. And she believed that her son's education would lead him to a respectable career, to financial security. She thought if he was an engineer or an architect, he'd be free from the cycles of poverty they were trapped in. Because you know, poverty isn't one cycle, it is many. And some of those cycles twist people in and on themselves, and others cause lives to spin out of control. Mom Gehrig tried to protect Lou from these pressures, but in one way she didn't succeed. Poverty cast a long shadow in his life that followed him always. Mom worked hard, and oh, she let Lou know that she wanted him to work hard. And he did, even as a young boy. Through 8 years of grade school, he never skipped a class. He never stayed home ill. One time, he even went to school with a mild case of pneumonia. His mother told him to stay in bed when she left for work. But he went anyway. And the principal sent Lou home only after assuring him he'd be marked present for the day. In the first half of the 20th century, education was a luxury most poor people couldn't afford. Their children regularly left school by eighth grade to enter the workforce, but Mom insisted Lou stay in school. And even though it meant she had to work harder, she saw to it that Lou went on to high school. He attended the High School of Commerce at 65th and Columbus in New York City. Lou Gehrig, who really is remembered for his courage and reliability, actually ran away from his first baseball game for Commerce. You know how kids are. Lou said someone told the bookkeeping teacher, "Hey, Lou can hit a ball a mile." So the teacher ordered Lou to show up for the next game. Lou said he took the streetcar up to the stadium. But when he saw all the people and heard all the noise, it scared him. So he turned right around, got back on the streetcar, and went home. When the teacher saw Lou, he threatened to flunk him if he didn't show up for the next game. Obviously, it was a different time in education. And Lou showed up. He went out for almost every other sport the school offered: football, soccer, hockey, basketball, wrestling, and of course, baseball. His senior year, Commerce High won the New York City High School Baseball Championship. And this meant that his team from Commerce would travel by train to Chicago to play Chicago's best team, Lane Technical High. And the championship game would be played in none other than Wrigley Field, a major league stadium, home of the Chicago Cubs. Mom didn't want to let Lou go. He pleaded his case, and she relented only after the coach met with her and her husband. The coach probably had to assure them the trip was entirely paid for and wouldn't cost them anything, and he also had to promise to literally watch over Lou. It's so interesting when you read different books because reports about the score vary, but everyone agrees when Commerce filled the bases at the top of the ninth, Lou emptied them. Lou, who had been hitless, now hit this long homer over the right field fence. It was his first publicized grand slam. Oh, it was a hit that would have made a big leaguer proud, and newspapers dubbed 17-year-old Lou the Babe Ruth of the schoolyards. 5,000 fans greeted those boys when they returned to New York City. Babe Ruth's hitting power and home runs were changing baseball. Scouts were looking for sluggers, and Lou Gehrig caught their eye. Scouts for the New York Giants took Lou out to the Polo Grounds for 4 days so manager John McGraw could see Lou Gehrig play. This was the first of 3 times when McGraw had an impact on Gehrig's career, and this first time McGraw just wasn't impressed. He was preoccupied. He was preoccupied with the problems and concerns about his own team, and to him, Lou seemed a big, clumsy kid who would never be good enough to play for him with the Giants. You know, it was a short-sighted decision. Oh, it must have haunted him all his life, because the rivalry between the New York Giants and the New York Yankees was long-standing, and it was intense. College scouts also pursued Lou, and it seems strange, in light of subsequent history, that Lou attracted more attention from colleges for his ability to play football than baseball. He had these massive, muscular legs and this tremendous athleticism that made him a gifted punter, and he actually earned a football scholarship to Columbia University. Mom Garrick was proud. Oh, this is what she had worked so hard for. Her Lou would go to college. And not just any college. Her boy would go to Columbia. In fact, Lou almost forfeited his amateur status, and he jeopardized the scholarship because McGraw, or his scouts, lured Lou into playing semi-pro ball for Hartford in the Eastern League under an assumed name the summer before his college career even began. Money was always tight in the Garrick home. Money was the bait. And Lou took it. Did he believe them? Or did he just want to believe that college athletes regularly played summer ball to make money? We don't know. We don't know for certain. Lou lasted only a few weeks in Hartford. He was homesick, and he was confronted by a coach from Columbia with the enormity of his mistake. So he returned to New York, and his case was argued before the Columbia Athletic Council. In the end, Lou was barred from playing college ball until the fall of 1922. Lou entered Columbia, an Ivy League school, but he was not a typical Ivy League freshman. He was poor, and he looked it. His parents were immigrants with menial jobs at the university. Mom cooked for the Sigma Nu fraternity house. Pop was a janitor. And the combination of Lou's painful shyness and the snobbery of his classmates made him a social outcast. Like snobs everywhere, some of his classmates didn't understand. They weren't better than boys like Lou. They were merely used to better things. On the field, though, Lou was extraordinary. One day in 1923, he hit a colossal drive. It soared over the fence, crossed 116th Street, and stopped when it hit the steps of the library some 450 feet away. And sitting in the stands that day, watching with pleasure, was Paul Critchell, a scout for the New York Yankees. Critchell recognized Lou's great talent, and he told Ed Barrow, the general manager, he'd found another Babe Ruth. And the next day, the Yankees offered Lou a $1,500 signing bonus and a $2,000 salary to play out the 1923 season. At that time, the Garricks faced staggering debts. His father was just in and out of work. His mother was ill with double pneumonia. She needed to be hospitalized. Lou's meager earnings from waiting tables and other odd jobs couldn't pay all the bills. So he signed. His decision provoked bitter, bitter words with his mother. She felt he was destroying all she had worked so hard for. His education. His future. In leaving Columbia, she was certain that he'd forfeit any chance for financial security. But the truth is, after Lou's first paycheck from the Yankees, until they died, neither Mom nor Pop Garrick had to work another day in their lives. Their financial security was ensured by Lou's decision that day. But they couldn't know that. Certainly Lou didn't know when he signed if he had what it took to be a professional baseball player. He was just young and eager, strong, and, oh, he was determined. Lou Gehrig signed with the Yankees in 1923, the same year Yankee Stadium opened. Though he hit a few times for the Yankees in New York, he played most of his first 2 years in Hartford in the minors. When he arrived in Connecticut, Lou struggled. He struggled on the field. He struggled at bat. He was frustrated. He was full of self-doubt. His lack of ability so appalled Patty O'Connor, the manager in Hartford, that O'Connor contacted the Yankee management in New York to tell them Lou would never make it. Lou was not the first young player paralyzed by his fear of failure, but it was serious enough for Ed Barrow, the general manager, to send Paul Critchell up to Hartford. He cut short his scouting duties in the Deep South to travel by train to the Northeast, and once in Hartford, Critchell took Lou out to dinner to have a talk with him. At Columbia, Lou batted .444, and Critchell told him he couldn't hope to duplicate those numbers now. Against big league pitchers, Lou shouldn't expect to hit as well. You know, there's a lot of failure in big league statistics. When a batter hits 300, he's hit safely 3 times in 10 tries. But if you say it the other way, it means a respected batter fails 7 times in 10 tries. Critchell told Lou one of the most important things a young athlete needs to remember. He said, "You can't be great every day. You can't. You can't be great, not every day." And Lou just relaxed. He relaxed into his greatness. After that conversation, Lou hit 7 home runs in 7 consecutive games. And O'Connor now recognized Lou's potential. In 1924, not yet 21 years old, Lou Gehrig arrived in New Orleans for spring training. It was his first spring training camp, and he brought $14 in his pocket. Naively, you see, he'd given all his money to his mother, and $14 had to last him 6 weeks because no one was paid until the season started. Lou knew their expenses were covered. You know, room and board, laundry, transportation to the field. It didn't seem to have occurred to Lou that his teammates would go out at night to relax, have some fun, hey, have some drinks, a meal taken, a show. Without money to join them, Lou Gehrig walked the streets in the evening, and he felt like a social outcast once more. He grew so desperate for some money that he tried to get a job as a dishwasher in several of the restaurants. When Yankee manager Miller Huggins finally heard about it, he called for Gehrig and basically told him, "Stop looking for a job. You have a job. You're a professional baseball player. You're a Yankee. You're on the best team in baseball." And he advanced Lou $100. Finally, in 1925, Lou Gehrig joined the New York Yankees full-time. I can just see his mother and father going to Yankee Stadium for the opening game in 1925, thinking, ah, there Louie would play that day. But he didn't. He didn't leave the dugout when the Yankees took the field. And I can see his mother trying to catch his eye, motioning, you know, go out, go out. to a man and woman who had worked long hours all their lives for little money. Ah, how strange their son's world must have seemed. He was paid more than they'd ever dreamed of to sit and watch a baseball game. America, what a country. But all through the exhibition season, all through the spring season, Gehrig sat. He sat out game after game after game. Lou chafed sitting on that bench, and he begged Miller Huggins to send him back down so he could play ball every day. Huggins knew Lou had a great deal to learn. So he told Lou to sit on the bench right beside him. And then under the spell of Huggins' attention and instruction, Lou relaxed again. He learned all he could from this man, his manager, his mentor, a kind of wise father figure he'd never had. It was fortunate that Gehrig signed with the Yankees and not with the Giants. Giant manager John McGraw was called Little Napoleon, whereas the temperament of Miller Huggins, the Yankee manager, better suited a young player with deep insecurities. Huggins was patient. Huggins was firm, and he liked Lou. He liked Lou's attitude. Huggins once told a reporter, "That kid Gehrig is going to be a great ball player. When he came here, he was one of the dumbest players I've ever seen. But he's got one great virtue. He never makes the same mistake twice. He makes all the mistakes, but not twice." On June 1st, 1925, Lou pinch hit for the shortstop. Then on June 2nd, Wally Pipp, the Yankee first baseman, developed the most famous headache in baseball history. A wild batting practice pitch struck Pipp in the head and landed him in the hospital for 2 weeks. And Lou Gehrig landed on first base for over a decade. It was the beginning of Gehrig's history-making streak. He played in 2,130 consecutive games, and his record stood for 56 years. Like the man himself, his achievement wasn't flashy. It was built inning by inning, game by game, season by season. It was built on commitment and endurance. For Lou played with headaches, stomach aches, back aches, sprained strains, torn muscles, broken fingers. Later x-rays showed he'd broken every one of his fingers at least once. He suffered 17 assorted fractures in his hands that he never sought medical treatment for. Oh, his vitality seemed inexhaustible, his hitting superior, his dedication unequaled, and all of this earned him the nickname Iron Horse, the name of those early locomotives which had also seemed invincible. Clearly, Lou possessed great strength and tenacity. And it also seems safe to speculate that Gehrig never forgot he had replaced an injured man. If Pip, a player with 2 home run titles, could be replaced, couldn't he? The media never forgot Wally Pipp's exit from the Yankee lineup. To this day, sports writers call it Wally Pipp disease, when a promising newcomer in any sport replaces a regular who's sidelined for a game or two. In 1925, Gehrig played for little more than half a season. Yet he batted .295 with 20 homers and 68 runs batted in, RBIs. For the next 12 seasons, his average never went below .300. Before Babe Ruth, batting strategy was basically hit 'em where they ain't. Players placed their hands fairly high on the bat. They choked up on it. They were contact hitters who swung with most of the energy coming from their arms. And then Babe Ruth came along, a power hitter. And he revolutionized hitting. He held the bat lower, close to the end. He put the energy of his whole body into the swing, coming up and under baseballs so they soared in towering arches. Some fans said higher than heaven. Well, since they took 20 minutes to come back to earth. Gehrig was a different kind of power hitter. He hit line drives, ropes. He hit ropes so long and sustained you could have hung clothes on them. And once Eddie Joost said he saw Lou Gehrig hit a line drive that never went more than 10 feet off the ground. And when it hit the scoreboard, which was over 320 feet away, it knocked the numbers off. Joost said, think about it. The longer a ball stays in the air, the more force and speed it loses. So how hard must he have hit that line drive to scatter those numbers like that? I've never seen anybody else do that. The way Lou could rip a baseball to any field with riveting velocity probably struck fear in the opposing team's infield. Talk about an imposing figure launching short-range missiles at you. But the headlines were all about the Babe. The discrepancy in attention Ruth and Gehrig received was real. Gehrig had the great fortune, and he had the great misfortune to play with and in the shadow of arguably, baseball's greatest player, baseball's greatest showman. Throughout the decade they played together on the Yankees, Ruth was the king, Gehrig the crown prince. The charismatic, unrestrained Ruth commanded attention. Sportscasters covered his antics like the weight he lost and gained. His evening activities, they covered it all as well as Babe Ruth's great achievements. Fans offered up their adulation of Ruth. In short, he dazzled the nation. He dazzled the nation. While the steadier, introverted Gehrig played in his shadow. Gehrig said it was a big shadow. It gave him lots of room to move around. I'm just the guy on the Yankees who's in there every day. I'm the fellow who follows the Babe in the batting order. If I stood on my head, nobody would pay any attention. As different as these men were off the field, on the field, they were teammates. Teammates first and foremost. George Herman, Ruth, and Henry Louis Gehrig formed baseball's greatest 1-2 punch. They were the most prolific duo and home run hitters ever. In 10 years, they hit 771 home runs. They hit home runs 72 times in the same game. 16 times, they hit home runs back to back. In 1927, that was the year Babe Ruth hit those 60 home runs, the most hit up to that time in one season. When Ruth hit 60 home runs, it was more than any other American League team hit that season. Before Babe Ruth, a total of 12 home runs in a season would have been good enough to win a home run crown in either league. In 1927, there was a home run race between Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig. Nothing like it had ever been seen in baseball because no one had ever challenged Ruth's domination before. During the summer of 1927, Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig were often neck and neck, but in the fall, the Babe just pulled ahead. He hit 17 home runs in September alone. Only rarely did a reporter point out it was the presence of Gehrig. Number 4, the cleanup hitter, batting behind Ruth, that forced pitchers to throw strikes to the babe instead of pitching around him. In spite of Ruth's dominance that year, the modest Gehrig built a reputation for himself that was anything but modest. In his role as Iron Horse, he didn't just show up. He showed up and he played awe-inspiring baseball. It was Lou Gehrig, not Babe Ruth, who was voted the American League's most valuable player in 1927, with 47 homers, 175 RBIs, and a .373 batting average. Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig were the two major stars in the lineup known as Murderer's Row. Earl Combs, Mark Koenig, Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Bob Mesual, Tony Lazzari. Many would say the 1927 Yankees weren't just the best team in the American League. They were the best baseball team of all time. They won 110 games out of 154, a league record that stood for nearly three decades. The team's batting average was .307, and the average for the eight regulars was .320. They dominated the Pirates in the World Series in 1927. They won again in 1928, something a team had never done before. Lou Gehrig's play during World Series games was even better than the great baseball he played during the regular season. In fact, some might argue Gehrig was Mr. World Series. When the pressure to produce was on, Gehrig had the ability to bear down. He ranks in the top 10 all time in runs, hits, doubles, triples, home runs, runs batted in, and bases on balls. During the 1928 World Series, his slugging average for a four-game series may never be duplicated. The slugging percentage is the number of total bases per times at bat, and Gehrig's reached an astounding 1,727. In 1931, Gehrig could have won the home run crown outright if it wasn't for a bizarre incident on the base pads. Gehrig hit an explosive shot into the seats that ricocheted back into play. And the man ahead of him, Lynn Larry, the shortstop who was on first with two outs, only saw the center fielder catch the ball. So he assumed the ball had been caught for the third out. Crossing third base, he jogged into the Yankee dugout. Meanwhile, Gehrig ran with his head down. After he rounded third base, the umpire called him out for passing the runner. There went his home run. And the home run title, it went into the record books as a triple. So Lou and Babe Ruth finished the season tied with 46 home runs each. Not only did Lou never utter a word of complaint about Larry, he came to his unfortunate teammate's defense, saying, "He's no more to blame than I." But Lou did set a record in 1931 that still stands. He drove in 184 RBIs. It is the American League single-season RBI record, and it remains the record for left-handed hitters in either league. Lou Gehrig may be the greatest RBI man in baseball history. His name is the only name to appear three times on the list of the top 10 single-season totals. His totals are 184 in 1931, 175 in 1927, 174 in 1930. Maybe Gehrig's greatest day at bat was June 3, 1932. He hit four home runs in one game. And he became the first major league player to do that in the 20th century. And if it wasn't for a great catch made by Al Simmons, Lou would have been the only major league player to have 5 home runs in one game. But this astonishing achievement, was it the top sports story of the day? No, it was not. Because for the third time, John McGraw just deflected Lou's momentum. June 3rd was the day John McGraw chose to retire from baseball. The end of McGraw's legendary career was headline news, not Gehrig's monumental performance. In 1933, the first All-Star game was played, and Gehrig was chosen by the fans to play first base. Gehrig, the greatest all-around first baseman in baseball history, made the team every year until he retired. And in 1933, at 30 years of age, Lou Gehrig finally fell in love. He wooed, and he wed a wonderful woman, Eleanor Twitchell. Lou Gehrig was a handsome man with rugged good looks, but he remained inhibited and reserved around women. Many men have gone to all-boys high schools. Many men have been busy and bashful and poor in college, and yet they find ways to date and they find wives to marry, but not Lou. He was too unsure of himself to ever pursue women, even when he was a full-fledged baseball star. You know, his teammates used to tease him. Hey, Lou, you ought to go out and get yourself a girl. He'd just smile, quite innocently. He'd smile and say, his mother was the only girl he needed. When Lou finally fell in love with Eleanor, his mother wasn't happy. Remember his mother's love was fierce? Well, she herself was a formidable woman. A woman who lived as a child in the same neighborhoods as the Gehrigs told me. Oh, that old Mrs. Gehrig. She was tough. I remember at Halloween, she never handed out candy to us. Never. Lou had to deal with the fact that his wonderful mother detested Eleanor. For the second time in his life, at a critical crossroad, he opposed his mother and he rejected her desires for him. Eleanor said she and Lou paid a tremendous price. She said they paid a tremendous price for their fairy tale marriage. When Lou met Eleanor, he was still living with his parents in a home he had paid for. But now, with Eleanor by his side, he signed over the deed to that house to his parents. He put all the money he had earned to that point into a trust for his parents. He didn't want them to ever worry about money again. He even bought them a new automobile. And then he and Eleanor got an apartment in New Rochelle a few blocks away. The rift between the two women never healed. Eleanor was a great wife for Lou. Where he was shy, she was vivacious. Where he was unsophisticated, she was sophisticated. Before Eleanor, Lou's world was filled with sports, B-Westerns, and comic books. But Eleanor introduced him to great literature, to the theater, to opera, to classical music, even to the ballet. Riches that they'd treasure all their years together. The first opera Eleanor took Lou to was Tristan and Isolde in German. Well, he, of course, could easily follow it because he spoke German, and he was hooked. During the winter of 1933, Lou immersed himself in opera. Eleanor said he spent Saturday afternoons sprawled on the floor in front of their radio, following librettos as he listened to broadcasts. The one thing Lou insisted upon was that they not be seen when they went to such highbrow affairs. You know how mercilessly guys tease each other. Well, Gehrig would go to concerts, but they could not be seated until the lights were dimmed, and they always left before the lights came up. Lou didn't want any reports in the newspapers about him getting culture. Eleanor wrote in her memoir, My Luke and I, that when Lou discovered opera and literature, she discovered him. She discovered unspoken and uncharted depths of feeling in him. Here was a sensitive man who responded with passion, with tears and laughter. He responded with a whole gamut of emotions to the power and the beauty in the arts. She said the experiences may have been new, but the feelings that they evoked were deep inside him, just waiting for release. Eleanor realized also how chronically and intensely Lou worried. She realized what a ridiculously low estimate he had of his value. Marriage seems to have suited Lou Gehrig, because in 1934 he won baseball's Triple Crown. The Triple Crown means a player leads the league in three categories: home runs, RBIs, and batting average. Lou's marks were 49 home runs, 165 RBIs, and a batting average of .363. Only 11 players in the 20th century won the Triple Crown. In 1935, Babe Ruth left the Yankees. Lou Gehrig was officially appointed captain of the team by Joe McCarthy, the Yankee manager, and it looked as if Lou Gehrig might finally get the press attention he deserved. In 1936, another immigrant's son joined the Yankees and eclipsed Lou once more. Joe DiMaggio was also shy, but his shyness was enticing, part mystery, part silky elegance. DiMaggio replaced Gehrig as the heir apparent, but it didn't stop Lou from playing great baseball every day, as usual. With New York wild about Jolt and Joe, Gehrig hit 49 home runs, 152 RBIs, and had a batting average of .354. For the second time in his career, he was chosen the most valuable player. In the second half of 1938, something happened to Lou. One day, his teammate Bill Dickey saw him looking out a window when his leg buckled beneath him as if someone had tapped him sharply at the back of the knee. Lou Gehrig suddenly stopped hitting. One reporter, Jimmy Kahn, suggested this was no slump. Players in slumps swing and miss. Lou was still meeting the ball time after time. It just wasn't going anywhere. It saddens me to tell you, the press began to cover Lou's poor play relentlessly. The winter of 1938, Lou tried to overcome his mysteriously failing strength by just pushing himself. He pushed himself and pushed himself all the harder. He took extra batting practice, batting until his hands were raw. The 1939 baseball season began with the shell of Lou Gehrig on first for the Yankees. In the first eight games of the season, he hit only 4 singles. Here was a man who had 8 200-hit seasons. For 13 consecutive years, he drove in over 100 runs. In 7 of them, he drove in over 150. In fact, Lou Gehrig was the American League RBI champion 5 times, and his 23 Grand Slams remain a major league record. His lifetime batting average was .340, with a high in 1930 of .379. In his career, he hit 493 home runs, hitting over 40 home runs 5 times and earning 3 home run crowns. But in the spring of 1939, all that strength and athleticism were just draining away. Now when he swung, he missed. Once, as Lou was about to enter the locker room, he overheard someone saying, "Why doesn't he quit? He's through. We can't win with him in there." Lou told Eleanor he stood there, out of view, struggling to regain his composure, before he stepped into the locker room, and then everybody just stopped talking, and he dressed in oppressive silence. Some people urged McCarthy, the manager, to take Lou out of the lineup. But McCarthy said, "Gehrig benches himself." Paul Gallico, the gifted writer and Lou's close friend, tried to put his agony into words. Can you picture the fear, the worry, the helpless bewilderment that must have filled Lou's soul? For suddenly his waking hours were filled with the terrors of the night. Those nightmares, dreams of shameful failure, of not being able to run when pursued. The strain physically aged him. His face grew more lined. His hair turned gray, but nothing forced a complaint from his lips. On May 2nd, 1939, Lou Gehrig benched himself for the good of the team, he said. Eleanor made an appointment for Lou at the famed Mayo Clinic. When he arrived, the chief diagnostician greeted him, then promptly excused himself. He retreated to Dr. Mayo's office to tell the doctor what he already suspected. "He's got a myotrophic lateral sclerosis. ALS. ALS is an incurable form of creeping paralysis that slowly and steadily robs a body of all voluntary muscle control. It was one of those strange synchronicities, because this doctor had just buried his mother with the same disease, and he recognized symptoms of ALS in Lou's shuffling gait and staring eyes." The Mayo Clinic report was issued on Lou Gehrig's 36th birthday. It was very cool, very professional. After the tests, the doctors invited Lou to go fishing with them in Minnesota for 3 days. Eleanor said she went fishing too, to learn all she could about this disease. She said she had 3 days to learn, to cry, to erect a new front, and begin to draw a conspiracy of silence around their home and around the doomed man inside it. Eleanor made the doctors promise that they would not tell Lou he was doomed. But he knew. On a trip, a group of Boy Scouts waved to him and shouted, "Yo, good luck, good luck." Gehrig waved back, smiling so broadly at the boys. And then he turned and said softly to his companion, "They're wishing me luck, and I'm dying." The awful truth was, Lou Gehrig was not made of iron. He was human, and he was vulnerable like us all. It was Gehrig's friend Paul Gallico who suggested they make July 4th, 1939, Lou Gehrig Appreciation Day at Yankee Stadium. Between the day's doubleheader, there were marching bands, speeches, gifts. On one side, Lou's current teammates stood in a line. And on the other side, shoulder to shoulder, stood those men from Murderer's Row, including Babe Ruth. And others were there, even Wally Pipp, the man he'd replaced at first base. When the speeches ended and it was time for Lou to begin, he couldn't speak. But the fans insisted, roaring, "We want Gehrig! We want Gehrig!" So with his speech in his pocket and his cap in his hands, he slowly walked to the microphones to speak to thousands standing before him, to tens of thousands more hunched over radios. What Lou Gehrig said during his short speech changed America's perception of him for all time. And in a culture where winning is everything, his words offered a more complex understanding of just what it is to lose and what it is to win. In the suddenly silent ballpark, he began, "Fans," and his words boomed and echoed in waves like artillery. "Fans," it went out. For the past 2 weeks, you've been reading about the bad break I got. Yet today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth. Look at these grand men. Which of you wouldn't consider it the highlight of his career just to associate with them for even one day? Sure, I'm lucky. He thanked his fans, the managers, the groundskeepers, and continued, "When you have a father and a mother who work all their lives so you can have an education and build your body, it's a blessing. When you have a wife who's been a tower of strength and shown more courage than you dreamed existed, that's the finest I know. So I close in saying that I may have had a bad break, but I have an awful lot to live for. Thank you." The crowd, greatly moved, stood silent for a moment before erupting in wild applause as Lou Gehrig stepped back from the microphones and brushed away his tears. Babe Ruth impulsively stepped forward, embraced Lou, and in response, Lou lifted his arm to Babe Ruth's shoulder. These gestures bespoke a depth of affection between two men who had not exchanged words in years. My friend Marianne's father, Gerald Fain, was in the stands that day with nearly 62,000 other cheering fans. And he said when the band played a song, they played it with a joyful, bouncy air. I love you truly, truly, dear. Life with its sorrows, life with its tears, fade into dreams when I hold you near. Oh, I love you truly, truly, dear. We love you, Lou. We love you, Lou. The number on Gehrig's shirt was retired. For the first time, a major league team honored a player in that way, and they sealed his locker. The Baseball Writers Association voted Lou into the Baseball Hall of Fame. They waived the normal 5-year waiting period out of their great admiration for Lou, and in part because they didn't think he had long to live. Some expected Lou might receive a post in the Yankee organization, at least for a year, but it was not to be. When it came time for Lou to look for a job outside baseball, in keeping with his character, he ignored lucrative offers and chose to work in public service. Fiorella LaGuardia, the mayor of New York City, appointed Lou Gehrig to the parole commission. The job paid $5,700 a year. And for the next year, with Eleanor's help, he worked 6 days a week. Eleanor said, if Lou appreciated the irony of listening to others complain about their bad breaks, he never let on. Gehrig told one young man, you've caused your mother a lot of grief, haven't you? The kid was Rocco Barbella, later known as Rocky Graziano, the middleweight champion of the world. Friends filled the Gehrig's apartment each evening. All kinds of entertainers dropped by. They dropped by to visit and to perform, too. One night when Broadway was dark, Tallulah Bankhead and company even put on their show in the Gehrig living room. Early in 1941, Lou resigned from his job. As the months rolled by, he grew less mobile, confined at last to his bed. And on June 2, 1941, 16 years to the day Lou Gehrig took over first base for the Yankees, he died. But Gehrig lives on whenever we retell his story and celebrate the life of this great man. The word star is bandied about so carelessly today for anyone who has a fleeting moment of fame. In actuality, stars are durable. Stars are so dependable that their position in the sky enables a ship to chart a course at sea, and that's how it is in our lives. We often chart our course in life by those we place in our heavens, striving to be like those we admire. Lou Gehrig remains a baseball star, and we have only to look, for his star shines still.